Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome back to The Bunker Daily. I'm Naomi Smith. Northern Ireland has been plunged into a political crisis with the DUP First Minister Paul Given resigning over the Brexit protocol. The move threatens the future of the Stormont government, with Deputy First Minister Michelle O'Neill also having to resign, as under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement, neither leader can stay in power if the other quits. To unravel all of this, to find out what it all means, I'm joined by Amanda Ferguson, freelance journalist and co-founder of Women in Media Belfast. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a groundhog day for a political crisis whenever it comes to Northern Ireland. So here we are once again.
Who was it that said something like, if there isn't a political crisis happening in Northern Ireland, just wait 10 minutes. It's like the rain. It'll appear.
Yeah, it's a pretty exhausting place to live, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us. And I'm sure that you are very in demand. So let's get right into it, because there is a huge amount to cover. Obviously, the protocol has been a source of tension for the DUP for some time. But what was the tipping point that led to Paul Given's resignation this week?
Well, we know that the DUP backed Brexit and that this has been an ongoing sore. The protocol isn't to their liking, because essentially they feel like Northern Ireland doesn't have the same Brexit that Britain has. Now, non-unionist parties would argue that the protocol is there to respect the sort of unique position that Northern Ireland holds in the UK, you know, to stop there being a hard border on the island of Ireland and to protect the EU single market, and that it mitigates against the worst impacts of Brexit. And indeed, a lot of businesses are benefiting from it as well. But we have had this non-stop discussion about the constitutional position, about the impact of Brexit. And then it all came to a head earlier this week when the DUP Agriculture Minister, Edwin Poots, ordered his officials to stop doing some of the checks at the ports in Belfast. Now, that's still part of a legal process, so we'll find out what's happening there. For the moment, the checks are continuing. You know, repeatedly, the DUP leader, Geoffrey Donaldson, has been, you know, threatening action if the UK government didn't take action on the protocol, if it didn't come as quickly as he would like it, that he was going to withdraw his ministers or he was going to take action of some sort. So that has followed with him withdrawing Paul Given as First Minister, which, because in Northern Ireland, First Minister is a joint office, you can't have one without the other. And even though one title is First Minister, one title is Deputy First Minister, it doesn't mean that the deputy is subordinate. It's a joint office. So that plunges us into crisis, and the parties are now trying to work out what they can do to make government limp along and try and get legislation and different government business through.
Because there is a raft of legislation at risk from this move. We're going to come back to that at some point. So we had the resignation. Before that, we'd had Agriculture Minister Edwin Poots halt these post-Brexit checks on food and farming products as they enter Northern Ireland from GB. Does that mean that international law has been breached, or are the checks continuing regardless of that order from Poots?
Well, the checks are continuing. Now, his department officials, he's ordering his staff to stop participating in that. We know that there are multiple people at the port, so there would be council staff there, there would be HMRC staff there, sometimes there would be border control staff there. So checks are ongoing while the courts work out what's happening around this. Now, we know that no matter what a political party in Northern Ireland does, that the withdrawal agreement, that the protocol is something that is dealt with by the UK government and the EU, they are the lead party in the negotiations. So, you know, it's up to the UK government to oversee it. Now, we know the Secretary of State has said that, you know, the checks issue is something for the devolved government, which to an extent is probably correct. But the overall protocol, you know, that's the UK government and EU deal. Right. So that's where we find
it. I mean, it certainly felt to Brexit skeptics, shall we say, like me, that this was a ploy by the UK government, who obviously desperately do want to renegotiate the Northern Ireland Protocol. They themselves aren't that happy with it, to absolve themselves of responsibility by saying, well, it's over to the devolved administration, agriculture minister. If they want to suspend checks, they can. So sort of getting their way, but without having to sort of carry the can for it.
Well, you know, the UK government is the entity, the group, the people who made the deal with the EU. It was to respect the fact that Northern Ireland is on a separate island to the rest of the UK. And because of just the history of here, the landscape, there was always going to have to be a border somewhere. Now, depending on who you talk to, people like or don't like the protocol. Unionists don't like it because they feel that it treats Northern Ireland differently to the rest of the UK, that it's annexing Northern Ireland off, that it's the pathway to a new Ireland, that it's making Northern Ireland part of an economic United Ireland. And while there may be, you know, an increase in trade between North and South, there's also divergence North and South because of Brexit, and that doesn't get mentioned very often. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's exhausting having to sort of pick through and do the fact checking whenever claims and counterclaims are made about either the detriment or the benefits that the protocol brings. But certainly nobody would argue that it doesn't need to be finessed, that it doesn't need to be made more practical. But what we've seen with this DUP move in the last couple of days is that essentially it's really just the DUP think they've made a great move, that the hardline traditional unionist voice party think that they're doing the right thing, that the Orange Order think they're doing the right thing, and the Loyalist Communities Council think they're doing the right thing. But on the flip side of that, all of the other political parties, including even the Ulster Unionist Party, and certainly all the business groups like the IOD, CBI, the Northern Ireland Chamber, have all come out and said that they don't need this sort of instability at the moment. Particularly as well, because we were due to have an assembly election.
I know.
In May anyway. So
well, let's see.
Like the DUP will say that it's about the protocol, whereas their political opponents will say that it's about the elections.
Exactly. So the DUP were obviously very strongly in favour of Brexit. Northern Ireland, on the whole, though, voted 55% to remain. So, you know, way above the average that we saw across the rest of the UK. So the DUP, you know, ultimately they got what they wanted against the wishes of the majority, and have then spent, you know, the last 5 years being sore winners, if you like, and complaining about the kind of Brexit that they got. So to what extent is this a move because they are fearful of their own sliding poll ratings and Sinn Féin's relative success, Alliance Party's relative success? Is this a preemptive move? Or to what extent is it a preemptive move because of them being very concerned about potentially ending up with a Sinn Féin First Minister?
Well, the DUP has been taking a hammering recently in the polls. You know, there is an indication that Sinn Féin would be likely to emerge as the largest party in Northern Ireland after the next assembly election. And that presents a problem for the DUP. I think it's more psychologically than anything else, because I referred earlier to the fact that First Minister and Deputy First Minister is a joint office, but a nationalist has never held the largest party title. The Unionist Party so far refused to say that they would enter government again if Sinn Féin was the largest party and they had to take the sort of secondary position, which is really a lot of nonsense. And I suppose whenever you're looking to the DUP taking this action now, there's so much jeopardy. We know that the term at the Assembly was due to end at the end of March anyway, and that the Assembly election was due to be held on the 5th of May, whereas now there's discussion about having an early election. You know, the DUP could have waited until the results were in on May 5th, 6th, and then said, you know, unless there's action on the protocol, we're not going to form government at that point. But they've chosen to do it pre-election. And I think it's interesting what you were saying about consent. There was no consent for Brexit here. Obviously, Northern Ireland voted to remain, but it was respected that because it was a UK-wide vote, you know, that's what happens. So that something needed to be brought in, and that's what the protocol ended up being after lots of alternatives were rejected. So the DUP are now saying that there's no consent for the protocol amongst the unionist community, but there's no consent amongst the majority of the public for the withdrawal of the protocol. And really, after all the years of the negotiation, what actually is the alternative? Mm-hmm. I think the solution's probably found in making it more practical, stripping away some of the bureaucracy and so on. But it's just, it's an absolute head melt whenever you're trying to explain.
It is. And I do speak to some DUP MPs from time to time, and I sometimes get the impression that this isn't that recent, that a lot of the upset and annoyance around the Northern Ireland Protocol, Brexit deal, etc., for the DUP is more like a foil for the fact that actually they would probably quite like a renegotiation of the Good Friday Agreement, because of course Ian Paisley famously walked away from those negotiations back in the late 90s. Do you think that there is still an appetite within their party to actually relook at the entire sort of constitutional arrangement between Northern Ireland and Westminster?
I think that there is a lot of insecurity in the unionist, certainly in the unionist political community at the moment, because of the change in demographics of Northern Ireland, of the change in sort of landscape, political landscape that we find ourselves in. You know, the Good Friday Agreement was in 1998. We're now reaching the tipping point where Sinn Féin look likely to be the largest party in Northern Ireland. They look likely to enter government at some point in the Republic of Ireland. We know that unionism lost its majority in the assembly. So really at the moment, the DUP's place that it can frustrate politics here is within the executive, and that's what it's doing. But it should be made very clear to listeners, because we are dealing with a lot of disinformation or misinformation. Northern Ireland's constitutional position is that it's part of the United Kingdom. And if there is a border poll held and people vote for something different, then that's the only way that it's going to change. You know, it can't be, you can't sneakily be brought into an Irish scenario without your consent to do so. And I think that everything that we discuss in Northern politics, every time I'm on radio or TV or on a podcast or anything like that, the constitutional position is always what underpins absolutely everything. You know, it makes me laugh whenever people ask, you know, is it an issue? And I was like, it's the thing we all talk about all day, every day, nonstop.
So we touched on this earlier. Obviously, with the Northern Ireland executive collapsing, there is presumably a host of legislation that is meant to be making its way through that is now at risk. What bills in particular are in danger of you know, being put on ice, not being passed, etc.? And what does that mean for Northern Ireland?
It's not quite collapse. It's kind of on life support at the moment, would be the kindest way to put it. I think that what we saw last time that government collapsed, because, you know, Stormont was only restored in January 2020 after a three-year absence.
3 years, yeah.
Yeah, and then almost immediately we were into the COVID pandemic. So a lot of the sort of new decade, new approach, you know, the wish list for both sides of the parties had to be put to the side for a while the government had to come to terms with the pandemic and COVID and, you know, lockdowns and all of that. So what we're seeing now is that in the last couple of months, the Speaker of the Assembly made very clear, look, we've only got a certain amount of time here. There's so much legislation coming through on things like organ donation and stalking and domestic abuse and climate and all of these different things. And, you know, he really sort of put a focus on, you know, let's get a move on with this. You know, we're not going to be able to necessarily get everything through. So actually part of the New Decade, New Approach deal was to safeguard against a future collapse. Westminster's intervening to sort of lengthen the amount of time from a possible, you know, withdrawal of first ministers to where it would actually be a collapse. And I think what we'll see is that a certain amount of business of government can take place, pending legislation can go through. But if there's an early election...
And within whose gift is it to bring that election forward from May?
The Secretary of State. It's up to the Secretary of State to call the election. At the moment, it's scheduled in for the 5th of May. But we do have the DUP and Sinn Féin suggesting that Assembly, the government, isn't going to be able to limp along. The legislation stuff should be, the pending stuff should be able to work its way through if government doesn't collapse entirely. But there are other really important issues like the budget, like health service plans, like COVID restrictions, the final COVID restrictions. The health minister has taken legal advice on whether he can unilaterally dispense with those final ones. And also there's the really important items like an apology to abuse victims. You know, the First Minister and Deputy First Minister were due to give an apology to victims and survivors of historical abuse at some point next month. And you can't do that if you don't have have, you know, a functioning executive in place. So it's just a really sort of horrible atmosphere, and there's you know, planned civil society sort of street demonstrations, you know, stand up for our democracy, that kind of stuff. So we'll see that in the coming days. But certainly, you know, while some people support what the DUP do or have done within unionism, the kind of widespread feeling I'm getting from the public is they're a bit aghast at what's actually happening, that we find ourselves plunged into crisis yet again.
Away from all of that drama happening in and around Stormont that you have so articulately laid out for us, you've also written an excellent piece about the armed patriarchy that is Northern Ireland. Tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, I did a piece for Open Democracy recently on women's voices in the Brexit discussion, because, you know, while I don't for a second think that the Republic of Ireland or that Scotland, England or Wales are some sort of feminist utopias, Northern Ireland does feel like a very patriarchal society. It does feel like we're behind in most things, including on equality. You know, still within Northern Ireland, we don't have the reproductive rights that are available to women in the rest of Ireland and the UK. And it does feel, because of where we came from, and women were kind of viewed as not being the decision makers, not being the political leaders, there's a hangover from that, where they're not always in the room or they're not always invited. And I looked at this from the particular angle of Brexit, about how women's voices weren't being included in the Brexit discussions, even in the high level discussions that there are between representatives in Northern Ireland with the UK government, that often women are excluded or there's only one or two women. And we felt perhaps because Liz Truss is now in charge of the Brexit side of things, that more effort would be put into including more women's voices. But like on her last visit here, there were no women included in the UK government video that they put out afterwards, you know, talking about how they've been on like fact finding, you know, meeting visit to Northern Ireland.
Well, she's very much a queen bee, Amanda. I'm not sure any of her videos ever strongly feature other women, that's for sure. I mean, there's definitely something of the Thatcher wannabe there. And of course, Thatcher, who famously didn't promote women into cabinet. Now, I grew up in Northern Ireland during the late 90s. What was really inspiring to me as a teenager in the late 90s was that there was a political party dedicated entirely to women. It was called the Women's Coalition. And I believe that at the time it was the only women's party that had elected officials anywhere in the world. But their electoral fortunes faltered in the early noughties, and actually the party ended up being wound up in 2006. Do they need to make a comeback? Did they not succeed because of that armed patriarchy culture that you speak of? Or had they sort of fulfilled their purpose? I mean, what would it take to break this stalemate now? Do we need a Monica McWilliams 2.0?
Well, I'm not sure if we do. You know, whenever I speak to the women who were involved in the Women's Coalition, they say no, that they don't need to bring that back. That was for a specific purpose. It was to insert themselves, you know, into the peacemaking process. And like, women have always participated in peace building over the years and have been doing great work for decades and decades. It just hasn't always been appreciated as much. And I think that it's just we're in a backdrop now of, you know, like Northern Ireland's femicide rate is crazy. We obviously have the historic issues around policing and community trust within policing that could have fed into that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was really shocked, you know, in following the stuff you've written about this, that Northern Ireland is one of the most dangerous places in Europe to be a woman. It has three times the femicide of England and Wales. What's driving that? Why do you think that's the case?
Well, you know, my intro to the piece was, when women's voices are excluded, you have to wonder if those doing the excluding didn't notice or noticed and just didn't care. And I think that what we see in Northern society is it's from the very basic stuff right the way up to the most serious stuff. You know, it's a spectrum. So, you know, we had a storm recently about misogynistic tweets. We regularly have media panels where women's voices aren't included, or high profile meetings where women aren't included. And people always use the same argument to me. Well, you know, but we had a female first minister, we have females leading the political parties, we still only have a third representation. And certainly whenever it came to the Brexit piece that I was looking at, the women who were in the room were very much saying that, like, they made clear that the fact that there was only, you know, one or two women, like Louise Coyle from the Northern Ireland Rural Women's Network, the Brexit expert Katie Hayward, it was ridiculous that there was no attempt to include women from the get-go. cycle that it's almost as if it's, you know, the politics of here is so extreme at times that it's men's business, that it's not for women's voices. And also there's a major problem with online abuse. I know that men can receive online abuse as well. I don't take that away. I know that men can suffer all types of abuse just as women can. But for women, it seems to be, it's more gendered. It's more intense. There's more of a sort of, you know, who do you think you are? Whenever you see all of the sort of smaller times this is happening, that feeds into a bigger, wider toxic atmosphere for women where their lives aren't valued as much, which ends up with, you know, rocketing levels of domestic abuse, which ends up with, you know, the amount of women that are killed here, you know, per head of the population just being really extreme in comparison to other populations.
I mean, yeah, it's incredible. I remember when Hillary Clinton came to speak in Northern Ireland at the Waterfront Hall, and it was only women in the audience. And I was so excited about it. And I was, you know, really young, and she was the president of the USA's wife and this, you know, incredible figure in her own right. And I was so excited to hear her speak. And her speech ended up being really quite home and hearth. And I was very, very disappointed that she'd framed it all as, you know, it's the mothers and the daughters and the sisters and the wives that suffer when there's conflict because we watch our men getting hurt and injured and all that. And I was like, I mean, really? Well, it was just very, very, very frustrating. But I guess her advisors had written that speech thinking, well, this is the kind of audience and this is the stuff you need to give them. So I agree with you. It's incredibly, incredibly frustrating. Is anything being discussed by Stormont about tackling gender-based violence or just even increasing the representation of women in policy discussions?
Oh, definitely. Like the you know, there's no shortage of feminist activists within the North, within Northern Ireland. You know, people like the Green Party leader Claire Bailey leads the Women's Caucus up at Stormont. The Women's Resource and Development Agency, you know, loads of different amazing people like Eileen Weir and Elaine Crory and Rachel Powell, you know, the feminist recovery plan that was introduced in response to COVID and other issues, you know, details out evidence-based information about how women's lives are impacted here and what we can do to make it better. So there are a lot of people with solutions there, if only the solutions would be taken forward. But, you know, we're battling in an environment where, you know, I think that like whenever Arlene Foster became the DUP leader, you know, it was Edwin Poots, the current agriculture minister, that made the remark that, you know, even though this was great, you know, that she was going to be leading unionism, that like her most important role was still as a wife, a mother. And it's just those sort of things just aren't said about men. And I think that all builds into sort of a culture, particularly around the Brexit stuff, where women just don't feel safe to be visible sometimes on these issues that they're rounded on online whenever they do raise their voices, no matter, you know, they could have qualifications the length of their arm, really articulate, amazing women, you know, being sort of abused.
Indeed, I mean, the women who gave evidence to the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee last autumn were subjected to misogynistic abuse on social media. I mean, Naomi Long, leader of the Alliance Party, gets horrific amounts of it. Where does the abuse come from? Is it always men? Is it younger men? Is it bots? Has there been any analysis of the kinds of accounts that are doing these pile-ons?
It's certainly not exclusively men, but it's definitely the vast majority of men that are involved. And I think that, you know, Rachel Powell from the Women's Resource and Development Agency described it as an abuse fest. And she said it's all connected to the patriarchy, that when women speak about political ideas, it's controversial. And then the mansplaining and sexism and misogyny and online abuse that follows, we just really marginalises women and girls. So, you know, there are solutions around this that are brought forward by people about how they can make life better. But I was really struck recently by something that the Green Party leader Claire Bailey said whenever you know, we were talking about femicide, and she said, you know, men need to tell us what they can do. It shouldn't just be up to women to change their behavior or let them you know, everyone else know, you know, how you know, we can be helped. It's up to men to have those conversations with each other, I suppose.
Amanda Ferguson, thank you so much for joining me on The Bunker today. You've talked us through such a huge range of issues that are affecting Northern Ireland at the moment, and you've done it in an incredibly fluent and succinct way. So thank you very, very much. We do hope that you'll join us again soon.
I will do. Thank you very much for having me. I'm sure another crisis is just around the corner.
Well, fingers crossed we get through this one before that happens. And listeners, remember, there's a new Bunker Daily every Wednesday, Thursday, Sunday, and Start Your Week on Mondays, the main panel show, of course, on Tuesdays, and the Culture Bunker on Saturdays. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on any new episodes. And if you like this episode, why not share it with three friends using the hashtag BunkerUp. You can also back The Bunker on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Just see our Twitter or Facebook, or search Patreon Bunker Podcast. This is Naomi Smith signing out of The Bunker. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.
The Bunker was presented by Naomi Smith, with audio production from me, Robin Lever. The Bunker is produced by Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronevich. Andrew Harrison is group editor, and Jacob Jarvis, lead producer. Our theme tune comes from Kenny Dickinson, and The Bunker is a Podmasters production.